John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and the push didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for November 14th to 26, 2010. The Palestinian Authority insists on settlement freeze in order to resume talks, and the Israeli military steps up attacks against Palestinian population in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report as usual with the non-violent activities in the West Bank. The details with IMEMC's Annie Rizabal.
This week, the anti-wall protests took place in the villages of Bilayin and Nilayin in central West Bank and also in Al-Masara in southern West Bank. Like every Friday, Israeli and international supporters joined the villagers at all these locations. In Al-Masara village, south of Bethlehem, four peace activists and a 15-year-old resident, Mutasem Sadi, were detained during the weekly protest against the wall. The demonstrators were prevented from reaching the land confiscated by Israelis and pushed back to the village. The demonstrators were prevented from reaching the land confiscated by Israelis and pushed back into the village when some young Palestinians threw stones in the direction of Israeli soldiers and several rounds of tear gas canisters and smoke grenades were fired. In Bilayin, West Ramallah, dozens of protesters suffered tear gas inhalation following the clashes during the march organized by the Popular Committee Against the Wall. Peace activists and international supporters joined village residents in the weekly demonstration against the wall and settlements. Demonstrators carried banners of Abdallah Abu Rahma, a leader of a popular resistance who is in Israeli detention since July 2009. His 16-year-old son, Mohammed, was also detained this week after raiding his house. Abdallah was due to be released over a week ago, but his detention has been extended. He was convicted by the Israeli court of incitement and activity against the public order. However, as soon as the protesters reached the military fence, the Israeli soldiers who were stationed behind it threw tear gas at them for more than an hour. In the nearby village of Bilayin, the weekly protest started after the midday prayer. Israeli and international supporters also joined the villagers, raising banners calling for national unity and resistance against the apartheid wall, the Israeli occupation and the settlement construction. The Israeli soldiers started throwing tear gas, metal bullets and stun grenades. As a result, dozens of people were treated for asphyxia due to tear gas inhalation. Protesters claimed that Israeli army also fired live ammunition at them. For IMEMC.org, this is Aneira Zabal.
Some Arab leaders warned this week of worsened political atmosphere in the region in case Israel does not comply properly with the peace efforts. Meanwhile, Palestinian Authority reiterated position regarding resumption of peace talks with Israel. IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari has more.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak warned of a potential violence in the region and possibility in the entire world unless Palestinian-Israeli peace talks resume immediately. The Egyptian President also called on Israel to stop settlements construction and go for such talks right away. He maintained during a visit to Bahrain that Israel might embark on settlement buildings on all parts of the occupied Palestinian territories if current peace efforts fail. In Beirut, Prime Minister of Lebanon, Saad al-Hariri, told New York Times that his country embraces a comprehensive peace deal with Israel and that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu does not believe in peace. Al-Hariri pointed out that Israel's security can be guaranteed in any comprehensive peace that would involve the Palestinians, the Syrians, and his country. In reaction to an Israeli bill to hold a referendum on possible withdrawal from a Lebanese village on Israel-Lebanon borders as well as from the occupied East Jerusalem, Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Muallim accused Israel of repudiating international obligations and having grand mockery of international law and UN resolutions. The Syrian official asserted that such parts of Arab lands were occupied by Israel in 1967, and Israel since then has not complied with UN Security Council resolutions that demanded Israel to immediately withdraw from which. Also this week, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said that the Palestinian Authority would resume peace talks with Israel if Israel stops all forms of settlement activities in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Israel had agreed to halt such activities in the West Bank only for a period of 3 months based on guarantees from Washington. At the internal Palestinian level, local independent figures in Gaza met this week with Hamas officials with an effort to bridge the gap between the rival Fatah and Hamas parties after the two sides failed to agree to a national unity for the fourth year consecutively. Rami Al-Mighari, IMEMC.org, Gaza.
Israeli military extrajudicially kills two Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and carries out 50 military incursions into the West Bank. The details and more with IMEMC's Alessandra Bajic.
On Saturday, Israeli forces entered Madama village south of Nablus. They raided and searched a number of houses and arrested four Palestinian civilians. In addition, Israeli soldiers invaded Beit Likya village west of Ramallah and fired at several Palestinian boys who had thrown stones at them. No casualties were caused. On Sunday, a number of houses were searched at Ithna village, south of Hebron, and three Palestinian civilians were called for interrogation. Israeli forces also searched several homes in Anin, northwest of Jenin, and later established a checkpoint at the entrance of the village, stopping and searching Palestinian vehicles. On Sunday morning, Israeli soldiers positioned a checkpoint in the south of Hebron and arrested a 14-year-old boy on his way to school near the Ibrahim Mosque. The troops believed he attacked an Israeli settler. The child was released on bail on the following day. On Monday, several other houses were raided and searched in Beit Ula village west of Hebron, where 12 Palestinian civilians were arrested. Also, several Israeli settlers from Shiloh settlement south of Nablus, escorted by Israeli forces, expelled Palestinian farmers from their lands in the south of Kariot village. On Tuesday, Israeli forces conducted searches into homes and arrests in the village of Takor, southeast of Bethlehem, Yatta, south of Hebron, Na'alin, and in the old town of Hebron. Israeli troops were also reported entering Jabal al-Mokaber village, southeast of Jerusalem, where they sized the building and forced its residents out. Later, settlers set up observation cameras and a fence around the building. The block housed 15 Palestinian civilians, including 7 children from the Karain family. In other news, several Israeli settlers from Maale Shomron settlement, east of Qalqilya, set fire to agricultural land belonging to a Palestinian from the village of Azun and burnt at least 10 olive trees. On Wednesday, Israeli bulldozers destroyed 4 barnyards and 2 tin-made houses in Al-Jiflek village north of Jericho, killing 15 sheep. Israeli forces claimed that the facilities were set up without licenses. Although many Palestinian civilians attempted to stop the demolition, Israeli soldiers injured 4 civilians and abducted 3 civilians. On Thursday, Israeli army demolished the house of 2 brothers in the village of Yatza, east of Hebron. Several houses in the area are threatened to be confiscated for the benefit of the nearby settlement of Carmiel. Also on Thursday, a local source has reported that a 14-year-old girl was wounded 2 weeks ago in the Shufat refugee camp north of Jerusalem. The incident took place after Israeli soldiers pushed her mother while she was carrying her on the way to a Jerusalem hospital. On Friday, sources claimed that Israeli soldiers demolished 10 structures in 2 areas in the occupied West Bank, mainly in a village north of the Jordan Valley. In a separate report issued by Palestine Solidarity Project, 4 Palestinians were arrested in a late-night raid on Thursday in Beit Omar. 2 of the detainees were identified as the brothers Youssef and Moussa Abu Maria, both prominent activists. The 2 brothers are accused of organizing the weekly demonstrations against the illegal settlements in the area. On Thursday, the humanitarian Road to Hope convoy arrived in the Gaza Strip, carrying 30 vehicles filled with aid and 101 humanitarian aid workers, including 8 who survived the Israeli attack on the Freedom Flotilla that killed 9 activists in May this year. The aid convoy crossed France, Spain, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria and Libya before heading to Egypt and Gaza. The convoy was stranded for 9 days at the Libya-Egypt border as the Egyptian authorities failed to grant permission to allow it to cross into Egypt by land. The issue forced convoy organizers to hire a Greek ship to sail to Egypt. In addition, a fighter of the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of the Hamas movement, was killed when he accidentally shot himself while cleaning his gun in Jabalia refugee camp in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Militants of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Abu Ali Mustafa Brigades, claimed also on Thursday night to have detonated 2 explosive charges beneath an invading patrol of undercover Israeli troops in the northern Gaza Strip. No injuries were caused. On Wednesday, Israeli army fired a missile at a motorcycle rider in Al-Zaytun neighborhood, south of Gaza City. No injuries were reported. However, later in the day, Palestinian fighters exchanged fire with Israeli soldiers stationed nearby. On Monday, the Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reported that an explosive charge was placed and detonated by unknown gunmen in front of a home in Al-Burej refugee camp in central Gaza. The targeted home is a 3-story building inhabited by 9 family members, including 4 children. One of the residents, Yusuf, and his son Ahmad, 22, were both wounded in the blast and excessive damage was reported to the property. On Saturday, resident Maisara Mohammed Al-Saidi, 18, was wounded in his leg when an explosive placed 1 kilometer from the border fence detonated while he was working there. He was moved to a local hospital in Deir el-Balah, suffering moderate wounds. IMMC.org, this is Alessandra Berger.
And that's just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and George Ishmael.
Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. U.S. troops killed an Iraqi civilian on the airport road when, according to the U.S. account, his vehicle approached a convoy and did not respond to hand gestures. The slain man turned out to be an airport employee. Kind of reminds you of 2006, doesn't it? Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. A roadside bomb attack on a police convoy killed 7 people, 3 of them cops. 2 more bombs attached to cars in at least one case, driven by government employees, wounded 4 people. Hilla, Iraq, Sunday. 6 mortar shells were fired at the U.S. military base, resulting in injuries to 3 Iraqis, including a policeman. Unknown what damage may have occurred to the base, or whether any U.S. personnel were injured. Hilla, Iraq, Saturday. 2 mortar shells hit a U.S. forces camp in the city of Al-Hilla on Friday, but there was no information on damage or casualties, a local police source in Babo reported. Basra, Iraq, Friday. 4 Katusha rockets hit the Basra International Airport, but no casualties were reported, according to a security source in the province, reporting to Aswad al-Iraq News Agency. Afghanistan, Saturday. At least 8 people were killed when 2 suicide bombers attacked the police headquarters in southern Afghanistan's Paktia province, a police official reported. Afghanistan, Thanksgiving. NATO reported the death of an occupation soldier from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, today, an Afghan trainee in the security forces opened fire on U.S. troops near the Pakistani border. The Taliban claims he was one of them. Now the U.S. and Afghan government are talking about limiting the amount of ammo issued to trainees in response. Mr. Barack Obama, the U.S. has now been in Afghanistan longer than the Soviet Union was, and nearly 8 years of war in Iraq haven't pacified that country either. Now's the time to throw in a towel. Bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
Upon conclusion of the recent two-day NATO summit meeting in Lisbon, Portugal, President Obama and European leaders announced their agreement on a timetable that would have the U.S. and NATO countries transfer responsibility for security to Afghanistan's fledgling security forces by the end of 2014. There are now about 100,000 U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, with an additional 40,000 from other NATO and non-NATO member states. Mr. Obama reiterated at the summit his commitment to begin an initial withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan in July 2011, with the actual numbers depending on ground conditions. The president expressed general optimism about the war effort in advance of next month's White House review of his decision last December to deploy an additional 30,000 U.S. troops into the Afghan conflict. Both American military and government officials have acknowledged that the Afghan war will only end with a political settlement and have facilitated initial negotiations between the government of Afghan President Hamid Karzai and the Taliban. But there has been general embarrassment at news reports that one man involved in the negotiations in recent months, presumed to be a top Taliban commander, was in fact an imposter. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nir Rosen, an author and journalist who spent a great deal of time in both Iraq and Afghanistan, about why he believes the U.S. war in Afghanistan is failing, requiring an entirely different approach.
I don't think anybody who has actually spent time on the ground in Afghanistan, apart from the military, would agree that there are any signs of progress. You may have individual villages here and there or towns that the Americans can hold temporarily. They can introduce a massive amount of American force, and then the Taliban will lie low or go somewhere else for a little while. But throughout the country, Taliban control more and more territory. Violence is getting worse. Resentment of the American and allied presence is increasing. And the Taliban are making inroads even in non-Pashtun communities. And this 2014 deadline is kind of based on a whole lot of ifs, all kinds of aspirations and hopes. And there's really no basis for them. The notion that the Afghan security forces will somehow improve and take over security, right now there's zero evidence for that. on paper, they may have 200,000 or so who graduated training, but in reality, on the ground, it's only a fraction of that. And we see that in Kandahar today, this massive new offensive that the Americans are involved in, they're not even relying on the Afghan army. We've spent billions of dollars on the Afghan army, and instead, in Kandahar, the Americans are relying on a virtual warlord who a few years ago was using Kandahar and actually turned hundreds of people, provoked them into joining the Taliban because he was so brutal. And these days we're repeating that, using the same warlord in Kandahar. We're destroying villages and orchards and farms, massively conducting operations that remind people of the Russians in the early 80s. And it's all for what? Nobody's really explained why the Americans are still in Afghanistan. Obama, in his West Point speech, explained that we were there to destroy Al-Qaeda. If that's the goal, that was achieved in 2002. Why on earth are we still in Afghanistan when Al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan? Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan and Yemen, in internet cafes around the world, and slums. It's sort of an idea, an inspiration, a motivation, but it's not in Afghanistan where we have this massive military footprint.
Nir, I wanted to ask you about the potential for negotiated settlement here. President Obama has said on more than one occasion that this conflict in Afghanistan demands a political and not a military solution. There have been reports over the recent months that some negotiations with the Taliban initiated by Afghan President Karzai had taken place. But where do you think things are headed in terms of any kind of positive result with negotiations with the Taliban?
It is true that this is a political conflict, and the only solution for it will be a political settlement. And the Taliban are an important Afghan movement, whether you like them or not. And it's also true that Obama has admitted that a political settlement is necessary. And even General McChrystal, in his assessment of last year, admitted that the majority of the causes of the problems in Afghanistan are political, economic, and non-military. And yet we see Obama and we see his generals relying only on the military as a solution and using more and more force, more and more violence, more and more troops. So even though they admit the problems are non-military, the solution to them appears to be military. There have been really no negotiations to date. Petraeus came in and basically killed the idea of negotiations and even put some key figures on a blacklist. Instead, they're focusing on killing and capturing Taliban. The American notion is that the Taliban are now in a position of strength, and we want to put them on their backs and punish them and weaken them and then negotiate with them. So we're killing the very people that we're trying to negotiate with. But an additional problem is, by killing the more established, older Taliban who are part of the communities, these guys are being replaced very rapidly by younger guys who have less ties to the community, who are much more radical and extreme, and who are more like Al-Qaeda in their ideology. So we're creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of a more extreme Taliban that is against the notion of negotiating with us and has more ties to Al-Qaeda, which seems like an insane thing to do.
Nir Rosen, there are many people who take a look at the option of pulling out of Afghanistan and think that while it would certainly save American forces from the expenditure of blood and treasure at home, that in the long run it might not be the best option because they feel into that vacuum would come more radical forces from all over the world and it would once again become a safe haven. How do you respond to the notion that if we just walk away from Afghanistan, things could get a lot worse and a new and developing danger would take root there?
I don't think it's true. I think just as we learned from September 11, so too did Al-Qaeda. And it's true, at the time of 9/11, you had kind of an Al-Qaeda army. You had an army of a couple of thousand, I think, Arabs who were fighting alongside the Taliban in the Afghan Civil War. And they also had training camps where some foreigners could come and get training. But all that infrastructure was destroyed by the Americans quite brutally and quickly and easily after 9/11. And many of those guys were arrested or killed. So I think Al-Qaeda has learned that the age of having sort of a geographic safe haven on any particular territory with bases, that's all over, because the Americans, that's one thing that we've done since 9/11, is show that we're going to kill people no matter where they are, no matter whether they're innocent or guilty, no matter whether it's legal or illegal. So the notion that Al-Qaeda would still want to have this these open training camps where American B-52s could just wipe them out and destroy the whole valley, I think that they too realize that that's over. And instead, Al-Qaeda has become something else. It's not an army anymore. It's a movement. It's an idea. It's an inspiration. something that anybody who opposes American imperialism these days, even if he's not Muslim.
That was Nir Rosen, author, journalist, and a fellow at New York University's Center on Law and Security. His latest book is titled Aftermath, Following the Bloodshed of America's Wars in the Muslim World. Read his articles online at nirrosen.com.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
On the 18th of November, D.C. officials held a public hearing on declaring Franklin School, home of the former Franklin Shelter for the Homeless, surplus, or can be sold to a developer. Didn't go quite as they planned.
Council Chair Vince McGray, now Mayor-elect, wrote a letter to the mayor, Benzie, about the closure of the shelter, about his great concern about steps taken to reduce capacity and whatnot. And barring new admissions, on September 16th of 08, the council had hearings and passed the Franklin Shelter Closing Requirements Act of 2008. The mayor, we contend, has never complied with that. There are lawsuits now pending in court, and are now in the Court of Appeals in the local court, as well as the federal court, about the legality of closing the shelter. So despite the fact that this act was passed, the mayor hurriedly closed it on September 26th of 2008. And I was there that morning. It was pouring rain. They threw the guy's stuff either in trucks or in garbage dumps. They threw the guys out in the rain. There were people with mental illness walking the streets crying all weekend. And they told him they had to go to Anacostia, okay? Since then, Lacoste has been closed. It was closed on October 15th. And there are people sleeping all over the world.
Be short, because they're not listening when you care.
Ooh.
The very fact that all these people have come here and said that there is a need for a shelter, for a school, for a detox clinic, for a healthcare clinic, the list goes on, means by your very definition of surplus, it does not meet that. It means, for your definition of surplus, 10801 says there is no further public use. There's been a clearly defined public use. There's a very clearly defined public need. It's not surplus.
Not surprisingly, a wealthy suit-wearing yuppie from a condo building at 1155 K Street showed up to say he hated the homeless, he hated the shelter, and he was glad Franklin Shelter was closed and supported Mayor Fenney and Jack Evans. This is no surprise from some of these condo owners.
I own and live in a condominium at 1150 K Street Northwest. My wife and I moved from Northern Virginia to the district with the hope of improving our quality of life by taking part in the great urban renaissance that is sweeping America.
Now that's an interesting choice of words. Quality of life was what Rudy Giuliani used as his excuse in New York for arresting people in the most trifling of offenses and was used in San Francisco to justify attempts to criminalize sitting or lying down on the sidewalk.
In regard to the Franklin School, we supported Mayor Fenty and Councilman Evans in closing the shelter.
So economic development is giving Donatelli $8.6 million in tax abatement because he couldn't make the George Avenue Petworth building's condos only apartments. Many of the people who lived in Franklin's shelter were working men.
That's right.
Not, they weren't drug addicts, and I resent the man who may live near there. He came from Virginia. We here in D.C. were already here when he got here.
Ooh.
And to smear men who lived in Franklin's shelter as if the majority of them were drug dealers is ridiculous.
Arguing that it costs somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 to $20 million for renting the building, and the city shouldn't do that. I'd like to ask them why the city spent $50 million as a gift to the Verizon Center to renovate their TV. So this is our money served also other purposes besides schools. Being turned over to developers, only for them to leave the buildings vacant for years. I've heard the complaint from some people, you know, that it's a problem for the buildings to be vacant, yet they've been turned over to private hands, and that happens as well. So I don't think the answer is, well, if the city is going to keep the building boarded up, you know, it should be turned over to private hands, because that's what's going to happen with private hands as well. If you take the Randall School, located at Half Street and I Street, southwest, it was turned over to the Corcoran Gallery of Art in 2004. It was serving as a men's shelter at the time. The city gave it to them for the third of the assessed value. It was assessed at $20 million. They gave it to them for $6.2 million.
I was part of the original Mayday DC crew that seized Franklin School back in 2002 and got it open as a shelter. My role was logistics, scouting, and intelligence. In 2003, when the shelter was closed at the request of the McDonald's that had newly been rebuilt at 13th and New York Avenue, we occupied the building again. The building was reopened. The Great Panthers bottom line, the occupation, they didn't dare arrest anybody. How can you guarantee to any potential buyer of this building that it doesn't get occupied again? We're still here. The need for housing is still here. A lot of people's lives were saved when Franklin became a shelter. People are dying in the streets now that the shelter is closed. So there is no way, shape, or form that this is a building with no public use, because people are dying since it's been empty. Lastly, if this building is turned into a luxury hotel, there is nothing anybody can say or do that would guarantee that somebody doesn't buy themselves a bed bugs from a laboratory supplier, rent himself a cheap suit, and rent himself a room in a hotel. And then you got people outside with signs saying, I'm homeless. I used to sleep in this building. It used to be a homeless shelter. And guess what? It still got the bed bugs. Yeah, it didn't have bed bugs when it was a homeless shelter, but that don't mean it ain't going to have bed bugs when it's a luxury hotel. Mayday DC, we stood for action, not words. Direct action was the motto for dealing with this city's housing crisis, and based on what I'm seeing here, it looks like that's going to be necessary again.
Let Mr. Gray know that if you see them tear down, you know, going through this whole process of shoveling that dirt to tear down the Franklin School and turn it into a luxury hotel, that is going to be the beginning of the end of the administration of Vincent Gray. Thank you.
Welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line, fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. With pigeons for his children and rags, welfare reform, let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line,
fat in your belly too.
Once again, we have to wonder what the D.C. City Council has been smoking. Last week, the D.C. City Council took preliminary steps towards passing two bills to criminalize protests at the homes of corporate criminals. While the real reason for the law is union and homeless advocates protesting at the homes of the mayor and people like Councilmember Jack Evans, they are using animal rights activists as their excuse. The excuse given is a blizzard of animal rights protests at the home of a Goldman Sachs executive seeking to force Goldman Sachs to divest all their stock in an investment firm called Fortress. Fortress prevented the bankruptcy of an animal testing laboratory called Huntington Life Sciences with $100 million in loans. The executive in question is probably also responsible in person for the taxpayer-funded bailout of Goldman Sachs, but D.C. Councilmember Jack Evans and his friends take their orders from wealthy developers and other corporate criminals, not from the taxpayers. The strategy of passing laws against peaceful protests and going to court for injunctions against peaceful protests has been tried before with catastrophic results. In the late 1980s, religious extremists besieged women's health clinics with nasty but essentially non-violent protests against a woman's right to choose. Clinic defenders held the doors open, kept the clinics running through the worst of these protests, but outraged activists and physicians sought legislative relief. The result was the FACE Clinic Access Act, which made the nonviolent blockades of our clinics a felony early in the Clinton presidency. The result of the FACE law was a storm of brutal violence. While it was no longer necessary to wake up at 4:30 a.m. to fight and defeat Operation Rescue at the clinic gates, the FACE law made the penalties for those protests essentially the same as the legal penalties for heavy-duty vandalism, fires, even clinic bombings. The result was an unprecedented wave of clinic bombings and arson, and a string of shootings that forced doctors and clinic escorts to wear body armor. After all, this was no more illegal than the peaceful protests, which may have been a nuisance, but took no lives and destroyed no property. In 1996, buttons were seen, including at animal rights marches, that showed a target bullseye and said, "I'm pro-choice and I shoot back," a reference to the wave of murders that only recently culminated in the assassination of Dr. Tiller in what can once again be called Bleeding Kansas. Jack Evans, Mayor Fenney, the rest of the council, do you really believe that in the light of these disastrous results, that the clinic access laws were a viable model to repeat? If not, the Residential Tranquility Act and the rest of these efforts to sacrifice the First Amendment on the altar of corporate profits need to be voted down and never resurrected. Black Friday, the 26th of November 2010. The winter's fur wars kick off with Fur Free Friday as marchers gathered at the site of a victory. The former Andrianas Furs around the corner from Neiman Marcus, also known as Neiman Carcass, is now closed. The space formerly occupied by Andreana's Furs is up for lease. Not satisfied with one victory, fur protesters moved on to march to the area's fur shops along Furrier's Row, beginning by engaging Lord and Taylor in a notorious fur-selling department store.
Lord and Taylor, the fur on your head!
It's blood on your hand!
The fur on your breast!
It's blood on your head!
Yeah!
No more
tension,
no more
stress! No more fur on your
breast! No more tension, no more stress!
No more fur on your
breast! Protesters also showed up at Bloomingdale's before marching around the corner to Neiman Marcus on Wisconsin Avenue at the Maryland state line. For over 10 years, protesters have brought confrontations over fur to the door of Neiman Marcus. This year was no exception, with a showdown at the front doors that forced the store to lock them up.
Neiman Marcus is closed. We're on the largest shopping mall
in America. The door is suddenly closed by security.
The largest shopping mall in America. Neiman Marcus is closed.
There they go. Sounds like it hurts. After protesters got finished protesting this kind of torture at Neiman Marcus, they went up into Maryland to the infamous Christian Dior upscale boutique, where protesters have been harassed and wrongfully arrested for protesting fur in the past. Unlike previous protests in both Maryland and D.C., this time around, police went out of their way to avoid provoking protests with unlawful arrests or unlawful orders. And if that isn't enough for you, a couple of Native American protesters in the action had something to say to all those white folks who've been thankful on Thanksgiving for land stolen from Native American people.
And I'm sorry, Neiman Carcass, seeing how you don't care about these animals here, you probably gathered around some dinner table with your family or some other people, gathered up to celebrate turkey genocide day as well. But yesterday was more than just a turkey genocide day, Neiman Carcass. Yesterday, March as a month on October 12th, in 1492, when Columbus came over here, about 518 years of white supremacy and domination on these stolen lands.
At another point, this speaker made a very interesting point about how the Europeans who arrived in the Americas exploited Native American labor to feed their taste for furs in Europe. The same upscale, wealthy fur industry that continues to this very day at hellholes like Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale's, and Lord & Taylor.
The online ProPublica news agency reports British Petroleum's extensive network of oil and gas pipelines on Alaska's North Slope has deteriorated to the point where severe corrosion poses a significant safety risk. A recent internal BP investigation found that 148 pipelines in Alaska received failing grades and indicated that 80% of pipeline walls had corroded and might rupture. Moreover, current BP workers charged that the oil giant's fire and gas warning systems are not reliable. BP's Alaska spokesman Steve Reinhart says the rash of F-ranked inspection reports did not create an immediate safety hazard. In 2006, two major oil leaks from corroded pipelines in Prudhoe Bay shut down oil supplies to the continental United States, effectively shutting down 8% of the U.S. domestic oil supply. Photographs taken this summer by BP workers in the same area showed sagging and rusting pipes, with some sinking into melting permafrost. In 2007, BP had a $195 million maintenance budget for its Alaska operations. Aging safety equipment like gas detectors worries current BP workers. 3 years ago, a giant turbine used to compress gas caught fire at a BP facility after an oil hose ruptured. A follow-up investigation by Alaska authorities discovered the fire and gas detectors were turned off at the time of the fire.
Shepherd Conservation Society will set sail from Australia on the 2nd of December for Operation No Compromise. You TV watchers out there might want to call it Whale Wars Season 4. The whalers were still in port in Japan as of Saturday, the 27th of November. Normally they would leave port between November 6th and November 16th. They have done so every year for the past decade. This time they are still in port, and they are so late leaving that Sea Shepherd will reach the whaling grounds first. Captain Paul Watson has speculated the whalers might not show up at all, but he is not taking any chances, and Sea Shepherd will sail on schedule. There are delicate trade negotiations between Japan and Australia right now, and Japan's illegal whale poaching in waters supposedly protected by Australia is the number one dispute between these two nations right now. So the whalers might be held in port until these talks are over. On the other hand, previous Sea Shepherd campaigns, especially last year's Operation Migaloo, cost the whalers so much money that the whale-killing fleet could well find themselves out of money and stuck in port this year, hopefully for good.
Well, DNA, it's natural, it's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one depended on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things, and now food crops grow on the ocean floor. Cows, they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
In recent years, China has become the world's leading producer of greenhouse gases, having surpassed the U.S. in total, though not per capita, emissions. China is also the global leader in green energy technology production, wind turbines, solar panels, transmission lines, and more, as it moves ahead quickly to modernize its energy infrastructure. So while it's building a large number of new coal-fired power plants, the Chinese government is also providing massive subsidies to its green energy sector. Those subsidies have drawn sharp criticism from the U.S. and other countries, who say they create an uneven and unfair playing field in the international trade of green technology. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dan Esty, professor of environmental law and policy at Yale University, and co-author with Andrew Winston of the book Green to Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage. Esty says that while subsidies to promote the development of specific industries are illegal because they can distort trade, there are some exceptions within the World Trade Organization to promote the greater good, such as environmental protection. But beyond the traditional culture of national competition, SD acknowledges that a policy of international cooperation could be a more effective means to develop green energy technology and rein in greenhouse gases that threaten all nations across the planet.
China has a major pollution problem and has become the largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world, overtaking the United States a couple of years ago. So there is a big issue around China's harm to the world ecologically. And I think China's become quite sensitive to that. And as a result, has made a strategic choice in a way that only an authoritarian government can, to invest strategically in the clean tech industries. And they put a lot of effort into building out a wind power business, a solar power business. They're investing a lot in new transmission lines, in storage, in new battery technology, and in electric cars. So they've made a very significant push toward trying to be a clean energy of the future leader. And they have done this with a variety of things. Some of it is helping industries get started, and some of it is outright subsidization. And there is now beginning to be questions raised because China is having quite a bit of success. They've got a great strength in engineering and good scientists, and they're coming up with some breakthroughs. And there is a possibility that China will be the leader of the clean tech industries of the future because of this strategic push by the government. The rules of international trade that are embodied in something called the Global Agreement on Tariffs and Trade provide that most subsidies are not permitted, are not acceptable under the rules of international trade. And one country can complain about the subsidies of another, and if the World Trade Organization finds they're in place, can order them to be removed. But there is some exceptions. There are some exceptions to that general principle. And there are subsidies allowed for certain favored activities. And historically, at least, subsidies to promote environmental protection were in what's known as the green box, the accepted category of subsidies, because they had a broader public purpose. So China's claim will be that these are acceptable subsidies, good subsidies, because they're helping promote an important public purpose, in this case, better environmental protection.
To level the playing field, why can't the U.S. provide subsidies to domestic green tech industries? Because that's what a lot of people here are saying is needed to get over this hump of trying to compete with, you know, with fossil fuels, which get a lot of subsidies of their own.
The best approach to creating an incentive for technology development, particularly clean technology development, is to make people pay for the harm they cause, to pay for their pollution, to pay for their greenhouse gas emissions. But the effort to get that kind of a pay structure in place in the last Congress has fallen apart, and it looks like the next Congress may not as well step up to the issue of making people pay for their fossil fuel emissions and for their greenhouse gases that are leading to climate change. So as a second best policy, it would make sense to try and provide some structure of incentives to get people to invest more money into creating these new technologies. And what's critical for our country to have a more innovation-oriented approach to environmental protection and really to move toward a clean energy future, and it may well be that the only politically viable approach is some structure of subsidies. And of course, the U.S. has put some money into clean technology. Part of the stimulus was focused on clean technology, but a good bit of that's now been spent. And the question is, how do we continue to drive the incentives for a clean energy future? And frankly, that's an important thing for us to be bearing down on in Washington. And I don't see a really serious political debate over how we're going to ensure not just our environmental future, but more importantly, our economic future. Because if we give up leadership in clean technology, this could be the next big economic engine. And it would be unfortunate to let the Chinese drive it rather than have the U.S. be in the leadership role.
How about global cooperation? I mean, if we're talking about, you know, climate change being a global problem, would it be good if all these different countries could have some kind of collaboration? Is that completely impossible?
No, you're absolutely right that climate change is an inescapably global problem. Those greenhouse gas emissions go up into the atmosphere and blanket the Earth. So the only way to move forward is in a very cooperative spirit and to understand that no country can solve this problem alone. And frankly, when we get breakthrough technologies, we do want to disseminate them as widely as possible so that everyone can bring down their emissions. So I am a big believer in collaboration in response to this. But I think the most important thing is to engage the private sector. And frankly, we want to engage the private sector across the United States, from big companies to back-of-the-garage entrepreneurs. But really, we'd like to engage the private sector and the entrepreneurial spirit all over the world.
That was Dan Esty, professor of environmental law and policy at Yale University. He is the author of Green to Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage.